Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeffrey Fawcett, PhD. We come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. For most of human history, families have prepared and buried their own. It's only recently that these practices and the laws around funerals and burials have changed. This is a society that abhors and ignores death. But here comes the baby boomers who have changed the rules for every life stage they enter, and now, finally, people are returning to a more natural and loving relationship with this important passage. Several years ago, at 90, with a heart valve that was almost completely closed down from an illness in childhood, my dad was in his last week. I visited him and spent the afternoon sharing affectionate memories and holding his large hands. He told us that when he couldn't breathe and got to the hospital where they gave him oxygen, it was like taking off tight shoes. I asked if he wanted me to return to be with him when he was dying. He said yes. The last time I called, he couldn't talk. I asked the nurse to ask him if he wanted me to come. He shook his head vigorously, no. The next morning, as we were driving to the hospital, he let go. I arrived to find an empty room. It took the hospital an hour to figure out how to honor my request to see him. Led to the bowels of the hospital, my father lay on a gurney with a sheet over him. His half-lidded cornflower blue eyes were serene. He had taken off his tight shoes. It was so important for me to see him and sadly say my goodbyes, touching his hands and apologizing for not getting there in time. Join us now for information about home funerals and green burial. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, PhD.
Thank you, Lena. Fluoxetine is a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. Its most famous trade name is the antidepressant Prozac, one of the most widely prescribed drugs in the world. At the 111th meeting of the American Society for Microbiology, researchers reported finding extremely minuscule amounts of fluoxetine in Lake Erie. The researchers reassured reporters that what they found was well below concentrations that could affect humans. When the researchers exposed Escherichia coli, typically referred to as E. coli, and another gut bacteria, Enterococcus, to this concentration of the antidepressant, it killed the bacteria. So it turns out that Prozac is not only an antidepressant, it's an antibiotic, and an antibiotic against E. coli, a bacteria associated in the media and popular imagination with food contamination, illness, and even death. Of course, this is going on in an open body of water, Lake Erie, far from any likely source of contamination. And while we might celebrate the death of E. coli, the researchers wonder out loud what the implications are for the rest of the microbial biome in the lake and the further effect on the lake's ecology. For example, it is known that the drug damages the reproductive systems of mollusks, that is, clams and such, and the brains of some fish. But not us, not humans. As I mentioned, the fluoxetine was discovered far from where one might expect it. The way this drug and other drugs make it into open bodies of water is through the outflow of wastewater treatment plants. If someone takes the drug, trace amounts are in her or his urine. When he or she flushes the toilet, the drug wends its way to a treatment plant. At the treatment plant, well-established engineering practices required by water quality regulations make it safe for the water to be released into an open body of water, whether a lake or a river. Unfortunately, the engineering does not remove the drug, nor do water quality regulations require its removal. The same is true for other pharmaceuticals as well as a wide variety of other biologically active chemicals such as pesticides and herbicides. You might think pesticides and herbicides won't come out in urine because no one ingests them, but you'd be wrong because residues of the toxins persist on food, which is eaten, which is metabolized, which is excreted in urine. And rinsing the food first only sends the chemicals directly down the drain and onto the wastewater treatment plant and then to some body of water. So long as we use these chemicals, they will be in our urine, in our wastewater, in open bodies of water, and from there, through ecological and hydrologic cycles, into what we eat and drink. Although that's something to consider, I want to move on by returning to what happens as a consequence of an antidepressant being in a body of water. The researchers are clearly concerned that the ecological web of Lake Erie is being damaged, but not us, not humans. The concentration is too low. In a recent study, researchers reported in the Journal of Gastroenterology that disrupting the balance of gut microbes in previously healthy mice using an antibiotic causes behavioral changes in the mice. Specifically, it causes depression and anxiety. The change was both behavioral and neurological. The level of a substance called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF, increased. Such an increase is associated with depression and anxiety. When the researchers stopped the antibiotics, the depression, anxiety, and elevated BDNF ceased. The implication is this. Kill off gut bacteria, cause depression and anxiety. If someone reports depression and anxiety, what will their doctor likely prescribe for them? An antidepressant. That could be killing gut bacteria, causing an imbalance, and thus aggravating the original condition. Ironic, isn't it? As I'm sure you're aware, the disruption of our gut ecology has the potential to damage our health in a wide variety of ways, far beyond causing depression and anxiety. How do we protect ourselves? A number of things come to mind. Better wastewater engineering, better control over the disposal of pharmaceuticals and toxins, reduced use of pharmaceuticals and toxins, better nutritional support for our gut ecology. Those pharmaceuticals and toxins are part of our way of life, intended to make life better. More specifically, they are developed and sold to make a specific aspect of our life better. The consequences are left to others, because the driving social force is the sale, not the development, not the better life. The consequences are left to others because better life means better life for humans with a specific condition in the context of a political economy in which things get produced because someone can make money off of it. The driving social force should instead be better life, period. Lake Erie, my gut and yours, every ecosystem, the whole thing. A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Now to our topic and guest, Green Family Home Funerals and Burial. Our guest is Jerry Grace Lyons. She's a minister, death midwife, educator, home funeral facilitator, and Reiki master. She founded the educational nonprofit organization Final Passages in 1995 to inform people about little-known funeral options, natural death care rites, and practicalities, green burial, and the benefits of bringing funerals back to the home and family care. As a pioneer in the new field of home funeral guidance, Jerry Grace has facilitated hundreds of family-directed home funerals, offering choices that specifically address social, environmental, spiritual, and financial needs. She's co-authored a complete guidebook, Creating Home Funerals, and has appeared on radio, television, and in worldwide publications, including the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, New York and LA Times, and the London Telegraph. Jerry Grace is featured in the acclaimed POV PBS documentary entitled A Family Undertaking, and she has also created and developed a multi-level certification program in the field of conscious dying and home funeral guidance called Honoring Life's Final Passage. So, welcome.
Wow, thank you so much for having me on your show.
Well, as you may remember, I contacted you because I saw the POV, A Family Undertaking, and was moved by what seems like a extremely natural and healthy way to deal with death. And it also it would be obvious to me that you came to this work because of the death of someone close to you.
Yes, that's true. It happened 16 years ago, almost 17 years ago, actually, in June. She died suddenly at work. She was a nurse taking care of an older woman. had breakfast with her, had come to work feeling fine, but after breakfast said she didn't feel well. They called 911. The paramedics came quickly, but they pronounced her on the way to the hospital. They couldn't resuscitate her. And she had a history of asthma, so it was probably asthma-related in some way. We're not exactly positive what happened, but anyway, she died quickly. And her friend, Norma, was informed by the hospital, and that her friend Norma had been made her Durable Power of Attorney for health care. And when Norma learned of her death, then she formed a phone tree quickly, and we all found out that day that Carolyn had died. So we met at her house that night, and Norma informed us that Carolyn had written out her instructions for how she wanted to be taken care of when she died. And those instructions said she did not want to be turned over to a funeral home, but rather to have her friends bring her body home from the hospital and bathe and dress her and have ceremony in her home, the way that everyone used to do it. And that she wanted, she named everything, flowers she loved, music she wanted played, things she wanted to be a part of her ceremony and on her altar. So she was very specific. And so Norma really started to try to fulfill those wishes, and we were able to bring her body home the next day from the hospital. And that caring of her that day, taking care of her body, bathing her, was so powerful, was so life-changing for me that it changed my whole career. And my whole way I viewed death, it diminished my fears tremendously and became just one of those transformative events in my life.
You know, when I was reading your handbook, I noted that the description of going through the process of figuring out, like you said, what kind of music you want played, what kind of, you know, what the experience is going to be like, is to stage that yourself is it's like the last chance you have to communicate with people. It's your last opportunity to share what your life meant, or even now what your death means to people. It's your last chance. It's your last say. And how important that is. You know, every piece of music that you play at that event is going to have an effect on the people who are there. Mm-hmm. So it's, aside from being the ultimate sort of theater piece, it's also your last opportunity to communicate with your loved ones. And I kind of chilled thinking about it. I hadn't actually played that through in my head. I mean, I was clear that I wanted, from my own experiences of being around people after they've died and animals after they've died, it's very clear to me that I don't want the body taken away. I want the opportunity to communicate still with that soul for a while. You know, mm-hmm. I don't want to just, you know, it's not. And the other thing is that, you know, there are lots of misconceptions about how much time there is to do that. I think that people believe that without embalming, if you have a body in the home, it's like, oh, it's going to decompose really fast, it's going to smell, it's going to be this and that. So very few people have experience with what it means to have a dead person in the house and what actually happens biologically.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want, I mean, I get that for you, the experience of being in the presence of your dead loved one was transformational. And I think maybe you should say a little more about that, what it was like for you to see a dead person for the first time. I think I already described how it was for me, but I thought it would be useful for people to hear that from you.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was, at first, we were very, a little anxious, apprehensive, because she came home from the hospital in a body bag.
Oh,
and
God.
We had seen her alive within a week's time, and we couldn't imagine in our minds what was this what was she going to look like? What expression would be on her face? Was she going to smell? All those things. And when we unzipped the body bag, she had this very sweet expression, almost a little smile on her face, and just looked so at peace. Mm-hmm. And it relieved us tremendously. Mm-hmm. And it was almost hard to still at that point to grasp that she was dead, which is one of the reasons it's so helpful for people to take more time, have more time with the person, their beloved, who has died, so they can begin to integrate and process that the person has died. Just because their heart is stopped and their breath is no longer in the loved ones around them, they haven't quite got it. They're still imagining that they're going to respond any minute. And that's how we felt about Carolyn. So it was actually touching her, the coldness of her body at that point, that helped us begin to have an internal process and a tactile experience that helped us realize that she was no longer in a living body. And that taking the time, just doing the kind of bed bath you would do for somebody who's ill, and just expressing our emotions as they came, being in the privacy of her home allowed us to do that and not feel intimidated, not feel rushed.
Mm-hmm.
So that was all part of it. And it felt like something very ancient to me, like, oh, this doesn't feel that unfamiliar, like this is perhaps, I don't know if there's such a thing as past life. Maybe this was something that I had experienced before, because it felt so natural.
Well, I think it is natural. You are listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone today with Jerry Grace Lyons, who is a death midwife, educator, and home funeral facilitator. We're talking about Green Family Home Funerals and Burial. And maybe if you could speak some about the issues of how long a body can stay in the home without there being a problem.
Absolutely. Now that I have helped with hundreds of home funerals, family-directed funerals, I would say that a body really doesn't change that much in the first couple of days. And it does depend a bit on the circumstance under which they die. Sometimes people who have cancer, their bodies are already beginning to break down some from the disease. But even so, with careful bathing and use of essential oils in the water, or like lavender in the water, and a nice soap, nice fragrant soap, and then using dry ice, which is what we do if the family is going to have a vigil or a wake, which most of the families I help have one for 2 to 3 days on average, although I've helped many families who've had the deceased home for 4 to 6 days. The dry ice really helps to preserve the body very well, and so odor is rarely a problem. And people can even, you know, if they want, open windows or have incense in the room. But it's not usually necessary. If they do a good job bathing and use of essential oils, there's usually not a problem at all. So the bodies do very well to be at home for 3 days.
Now, dry ice is, in fact, a chemical, but it can be contained. You know, you can have it in some kind of container and then put, you know, under something, under the body. And this is in contrast to what happens in a funeral home. And I would say that my suspicion is that even if there isn't an embalming process going on, that I know that funeral homes have to adhere to very strict health and safety rules because people die sometimes of infectious diseases. And you're handling their fluids, and their fluids are being disposed of somehow. Do you want to talk at all about some of the concerns you have about funeral, the way funeral directors and these places deal with the bodies? I mean, do you feel that they are actually not harming the environment, or do you think there are some concerns about what happens in those places?
Well, there is some concern. Embalming is, first of all, most people think it's a requirement, and that's one of those pieces of misinformation that's floating around, and I like to let people know that immediately. It's not required. It isn't generally necessary at all for any reason other than the funeral homes feel they can make the person look more alive by using the fluid, the embalming fluid. But most of them have formaldehyde in them, and that is dangerous to the embalmer.
Very.
They have an early death rate, actually, in this country from just breathing in the fumes. The embalming fluid, well, it's perhaps not a hazard unless it's the body is being buried near a water table. But it is just more a hazard to the embalmer. However, in order to embalm somebody, you have to open the body mm-hmm. and drain the blood from the body, mm-hmm. and that is the worst time to be doing it because there can be bloodborne pathogens, mm-hmm. and where does the blood go? A lot of times it just goes down the drain, so that's not a good thing. And so really the body being kept intact is the best. And so, again, it's just something that started back in the Civil War, the whole thing with embalming, trying to get the soldiers back home when they were killed in the battlefield. And from that, it sort of caught on as, oh, gee, we can keep a body preserved a little longer and make them look like they're not dead. And so it just somehow grew out of that as a tradition for funeral directors, and also the one thing that separates the dead from the living. Funeral directors now feel they, because they embalm, they're the only ones that can embalm. They have to get a license to do this and learn how to do this, because otherwise caring for the dead is something very natural, and people have done it since time began and still do around the world. So
there are some practices done during they don't just drain the blood. They do some rather ghastly things that I think if people knew about would not agree to. And some of that is revealed in the film A Family Undertaking, the POV PBS film, which is quite good. If people feel up to watching this, it's quite good. It's not ghastly, but they do describe what takes place. And one of the ironies for me is that we are made of this earth, and what should happen is that we go back to the soil and feed the earth. If you don't want to be cremated, to be embalmed or in a casket and to be buried 6 feet under, where, as you pointed out to me, I didn't know this, there are no organisms that will be there to feed off of this organic material you just put in the ground. I've always felt, gee, I would like to go back and feed the earth that gave me life. You know, I would like that to happen. So then we're looking at green burials, because otherwise, you know, and also when you look at cemeteries, I note that the trees are on the perimeter of the cemetery. The cemetery is a big flat space with nothing much growing on it. And these bodies in the ground, it's just an odd use of ground. And so now we have this new movement toward green burial. It's fairly new. And I'd like it if you could explain what that means.
Well, I think the easiest way to think about green burial is earth-friendly and not single-use, which then cannot be used in any other way other than a big, giant lawn that takes pesticides and herbicides to keep it looking green and so they can mow it easily. So if we're talking green, we want to think about placing someone in the earth with the least impact, not putting the 90,000 tons of steel caskets in the ground every year in this country, enough to build the Golden Gate Bridge every year, and not putting in the 827,000 gallons of embalming fluid filled with formaldehyde, and also not putting in the reinforced concrete vaults, the grave liners, which is over a million tons of this concrete. Again, enough to build a highway from San Francisco to Arizona. It's just crazy, the resources that we're using. So a green burial would be the opposite of that. It would be placing the body in the earth with the least amount of things in the earth, a biodegradable casket, such as pine, soft wood, or even just in a shroud. And no embalming and no grave liner, no made out of cement or plastic, which is what a lot of the lawn cemeteries are using now. And
a relatively shallow grave compared to the 6 foot depth.
Yes, in 3 to 4 feet deep. Actually, the microorganisms are at around 2 feet. And so a relatively shallow grave, just deep enough so that there won't be any, you know, chance that an animal might be able to smell anything. But 3 feet deep is fine. It's perfect. So those are all, and the best case scenario is that it would be in preserving the land as park. So it would be used as land conservation. And a place where people could plant indigenous plants or trees on the grave or around there and have it look like a park. And we could just walk around, have a picnic. And yes, they do that in England now. They have woodland sites all over where people can go and picnic there.
There aren't a lot of green burial cemeteries certainly in where we live in California.
No.
I looked into this, and although one of the cemeteries that is close to both of us, because we live, well, both of us in West Sonoma County, they have the standard style, which is this big flat place with a rim of trees on the outside. And I guess they finally have succumbed to this idea of doing a green burial. You did the first one recently there, and you showed us some photos of the whole funeral and process, which was very moving.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that was lovely was that because this woman who had died fairly young at 52 was a permaculturist, she had her own compost with her own worms and her own soil put in the ground. So if you can't, you know, in the old days, if you lived on the land, you had a family plot. And now apparently there's so much paperwork and so much legality to this whole issue of what to do with the body that it's very difficult to arrange for these methods. So that was the next best thing. But even at this cemetery, they're not quite ready to let you plant a tree on the site.
Yeah. Not right on the grave, but actually the owner of our local cemetery has agreed to let people plant a tree right next to the grave, one of the ones that we just helped facilitate. As long as it's in an area that's going to work for the overall
mm-hmm.
cemetery, he
mm-hmm.
will let people certainly put flowers on the grave and, I mean, plant them.
Plant them.
Then he also said that they could plant a tree right at the corner, so right near. And there's a tree right at the head of the grave as well.
That's good.
Yeah.
We need to take just a brief musical break. We're going to come right back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett. We're interviewing Jerry Grace Lyons. Her company is called, well, it's Life. It's Final Passage is the name of her company. And when she comes back after this break, we'll give out that website. We're talking about green family home funerals and burials. If you stay with us, we'll be right back.
Life is over, I'll fly away.
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone today with Jerry Grace Lyons, who is a minister and death midwife. I just want to remind you that you can get information about Your Own Health and Fitness, our guests, our practice, a free stream of the show, our archive, CD copies, our book, all at yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out. You can also reach us by email at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. And Jerry Grace, if you would, give out some contact information for your organization.
Thank you. Yes, www.finalpassages.org, O-R-G. And our phone number, 707-824-0268.
I have to say that song is my favorite in terms of the sense of joy.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, I had a dear friend that was a mentor that I did a memorial for, and people who have listened to the show for many years would remember Claire Felix. And when she was anticipating her death, I think I told you this, that I asked her how she felt about that, and she said, "Oh, I feel free."
Mm.
And then you and I talked about the film about Jack Kevorkian, You Don't Know Jack, which is, You Don't Know Jack. And there's, on the bonus features, there's this wonderful interview with him, and he says, what is the problem that people have about death? He says, it's part of nature. You're all going to die. What's wrong with it? You just go back into nothingness. Big deal. You came from nothingness. Was that so bad? So even if you don't believe in anything, if you just believe that you go back where you came from, to have somebody remind you that it wasn't so terrible the first time around. And then you sent me this amusing story about the twins, where they use the metaphor of the womb, like us living in the world, and thinking that the next stage, we don't know what's going to happen the next stage, and oh, we're so frightened, and we have this great mother that's taking care of us, and we don't know what's going to happen, and something's going to happen, we're going to get born, and maybe it'll be over. And the other twin says, you know, which we don't know if the mother really exists, we've never seen her, and how can, we don't know. And then the birth happens, and they are astonished when they see, they're just overjoyed when they see what happens. So there's that sense of the mystery, of course, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, it's, as Carly Simon says in her song, Life is Eternal, it's just death is just a horizon, and we're limited by our sight. We don't know. At one point, everybody thought the world was flat and we were going to drop off because that's what it looked like in the horizon. But then we came to find that it goes on. So, I mean, it is the great mystery, and certainly we can choose to embrace it, or we can choose to let the fear run our lives. And it's a choice that we all have.
Well, making a conscious choice about how you're handled after you make that passage is, I think, a way for people to begin to have a relationship with death, so that it is a part of life, and it is fraught with that sense of mystery. I mean, I told you that, certainly when I stood and interacted with my father after he passed, I felt him in the room. I was very clear that he was there. It was palpable, and I'm not attached to that reality. I just felt it. I felt him palpably in the room. And after Oscar died, who was my animal companion that I was so attached to, even though I've had many animal companions, none of them were like him. He was definitely around for at least 6 weeks, and he still shows up from time to time. So I never felt that before, and now it, you know, left me with questions that I didn't have. But certainly handling his body and his death as consciously as we did, and allowing him to die naturally, and bathing him and being with his body afterwards overnight and all of that, was incredibly... I mean, there's a grieving process that goes on, and it's kind of a physical process, and it feels to me like this sort of conscious interaction with the dead is healing.
Very healing. I get to witness that all the time. That's good fortune for me, is watching people transform, walking through their fears, and seeing how keeping the body at home really helps support the grieving process. People get an opportunity to say things they had not said, and they report to me all the time that they've had contact in some way or a message brought to them in some way by the person. A flower outside the window showing up that it at the wrong time of year for that plant to flower. And they just knew that it was a message. We hear this all the time. I certainly experienced that from Carolyn when she died. I felt direct contact from her, and she kept urging me to go back and be a part of her home funeral. And it was real direct. I mean, I felt like she was talking to me directly. And even my father on his deathbed, I heard him say words to me, which is not, it's just not an everyday occurrence for me either. But now I see it all the time with families, and I see expressions on the face of the deceased. I see them smile almost always within the next day or two. There's a smile, and the families will come and say, look, they're smiling. And they're so surprised. And I just think it's so amazing to watch the transformation, how the faces change, and how the people around them feel at peace and calm, anything but anxious or, you know, distraught. I mean, certainly they're in grief, but it is with calmness. And they're just, you know, they love participating in things like decorating the casket or even building it. But we see, I have hundreds of photos of beautifully decorated caskets and the families and caring for this person in such a tender way, a way that no one else would handle them that way, but the people who love them the most. And then they lift them and place them in the casket and drive them to the crematorium or the cemetery themselves.
And in fact, children are part of this process as well, and they don't seem to be perturbed. I think part of the reason children get perturbed is if their parents are perturbed, you know.
Correct. Yeah, they're really looking to the adults as their models. In some cases, we've had little ones almost be the role model for the adults.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen them take their hands, lead them into the room where the person was lying in honor, and say, you can sit down and talk to them or hold their hand, you know. So kids seem to embrace this very easily. Sometimes the teens have a little bit of difficulty accepting the idea of keeping somebody at home, but there again, I've watched tremendous transformation from anger at a sudden death to being the next day coming back to the home and seeing them with all their friends just acting very naturally around the one young man's father who was killed in a motorcycle accident.
Oh.
Yeah, it's so sudden and so hard, and he was so angry when we talked about bringing his body back home from the corner. But, boy, he just went there, and after a while, and getting to see him all cared for and dressed and laid out and flowers all around. And then his friends came, and he was just able to be there, right there in the midst of it all. And later, going back, even after the whole thing was over, and having him give me a big hug and a smile and say thank you for helping us. So that really melted my heart completely to see this teen who was so, so angry and so horrified at what had happened to being at peace with it.
So you mentioned the coroner. And you lent me a copy of Final Passages Creating Home Funerals, you know, your binder full of materials, and I was rather impressed by all of the paperwork and, you know, the arrangements that have to be made to do this. So what are the impediments? Can you give us an idea of what has to happen to do this?
Well, if someone dies suddenly, And there's no doctor knows why the person died, then it becomes a coroner investigation. If the body ends up there at the coroner and they determine that an autopsy is needed, then they will go ahead and do that. That doesn't mean that the family doesn't have a right to have the person come back to their home and still have a bit of service at home or ceremony or something private in their own home. But it does take getting through the paperwork. Family has the right to file a death certificate, and in the state of California, there's two forms they have to file, the death certificate and a disposition form, which is a form that says what's going to happen to the body. In other words, is it going to be cremated or is it going to be buried and where? And those two documents have to be filed together with the office, at the Office of Vital Records in the county where the person died. So our guidebook helps people fill out that paperwork, take all the steps they need to get that completed before contacting the coroner and saying they want to, or they can let the coroner know right away that they want to bring the body home when they're complete with it. So, you know, you want to be thoroughly prepared with what you're going to face. An autopsy is not an easy thing to see. It is quite invasive to the body. So, that's again where we can help, educate, inform people about what they're going to be facing.
Yeah. Well, and your group and other people like you will actually facilitate and be with people to help them through these things. So one piece of advice here, I guess, along with making sure your wishes are written down and are in various places, you know, like your safe deposit box, and other people have your paperwork, and they even say to put it in the freezer, because a medic who comes in, if something happens to you, will look in the freezer for your wishes, is maybe not to die suddenly if you can avoid it. Just so you know, I think it's happening. Let's not do the coroner. It's nice when people are able to be in a hospice situation or a home death situation so that those things don't happen. If it's not a convoluted or unusual circumstances or has to be investigated, is it fairly simple? Or, I mean, my impression is that this is so new in some ways that, for instance, I asked you, look, I live in the woods. I want to be buried in the redwood trees, you know, but, and I'm in the process of trying to find out since we're not in a city, and I know the water table has to be, you know, there's different things, but I just wonder what sorts of considerations and issues and impediments there are these days to all of this.
Well, again, you're absolutely right in saying that because we're reclaiming this, or it's restoring this as tradition, because this is our tradition. I say what we do today in funeral homes is conventional funeral care, and what we're talking about is traditional care. And so for a lot of people, it's a very new idea, and having somebody to help facilitate makes things go very smooth and very easy, and people don't have to worry about are they doing this correctly or that correctly. And I support people with helping them get paperwork done and all the things they may need to so they're not burdened by it. The paperwork being legal, you can't make any mistakes. There's no whiteouts, no cross-offs, no erasures, those kinds of things. So that can be a little difficult. So it depends on the size of support group that you have when somebody dies. If they could read our guidebook and say, okay, we have 15 people here, let's, you know, break it up into different groups and everybody take a different part. But if it's really a small family or they don't want to be bothered with having to type paperwork, then they may look to having a facilitator. As far as burying in the backyard in California, it's not easy. I haven't heard of anyone being able to pull it off. Some states, they make it easier than this state. And if you have a an old family plot already on your land, you might be able to continue burying your family there. But starting a new one could be very difficult. So
I guess animal cemeteries don't count as a family plot. Look, there's Oscar.
And that's
there's
so
Schmoo.
No, but...
There's the little rat, Grace, that we had to... okay, so you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with Jerry Grace Lyons. Her website is finalpassages.org, and we're talking about green family home funerals and burial. What states are more permissive? Do you have any of them in your head?
I'd say the more rural. I don't specifically. I believe in New Mexico. I've had some people tell me they did some burial there. In Oregon, in rural areas, you can still bury on your own land. And I would say probably states like Wyoming, Montana, that are have more rural area in within their state. That would probably be easier than the more dense urban area places. So specifically, I will mention that there is a book called Final Rites put out by Lisa Carlson and Josh Slocum, and it just came out hot off the press, has all of the laws for home or family-directed funerals in her book, in their book. So you can look up Final Rites.
R-I-G-H-T-S?
Yes, R-I-G-H-T-S. And
Slocum and what's the other last name?
Slocum and Carlson.
Carlson.
And that will help people know what how to take care of home funerals in their own state, other than California, which I'm pretty familiar with.
We have enough time to do two things that I thought would be interesting. One is that I think we shouldn't end this interview without you telling a few more stories, if you have some stories that you want to tell that are moving or informative in some way. You've already been doing some of that. And then the other is that, you know, it's so funny that we have no relationship to death here in this country, but our TV and our films are intensely violent. I mean, just extremely violent. So there's death all over the place in these things. And the death, as depicted, is not very realistic. For instance, people say a few words and then they turn their heads and their eyes close. And that's not what happens. So there must be some things that are surprising to people that you might be able to demystify so you can be prepared. For instance, the idea that the eyes and the mouth actually are usually open. And some people, like I, when I saw my dad, were actually glad to see his eyes, especially because they were so relaxed and, you know, tender looking. But there are some little things you can do if that's not comfortable. I don't, do you want to talk about some of that stuff? You want to talk
mention
about some
that
of that
real quickly? And our guidebook does have details about all
that
of
and fluids too. Yes,
how to care for the body is the whole middle section of our book. But there are little things you can do. The eyes. Some people like to look at the eyes. If they're going to have a 3-day wake, generally the eyes change over the next day or so. There'll be, you know, they'll kind of glaze over and not look the same as they do when there's life behind that. And so often people at some point would like to close the eyes. And there's things we suggest in the guidebook, such as laying something like a baggie with salt or sand or something a little heavy in it on the eyelids. If that doesn't work, there's a suggestion of using a little bit of cotton from the end of a Q-tip, and you can place that under the eyelid, and that will give the eyelid something to hold onto, and it will stay closed. And same with the mouth, closing the mouth, you can use a scarf to tie over the head, or I use an ACE bandage, something that grips and doesn't slide off the hair, and but you have to tie it pretty tightly. Once rigor mortis sets in, which takes about 4 to 6 hours, it's different for everybody a bit. And then you can remove that, and the mouth will stay closed at least for a day or two.
Yeah, because rigor goes away after a while,
too. Go away, yeah, for a bit.
Yeah, there's this odd transition where first they're stiff, and then all of a sudden they're pliant again, which gives you this moment of feeling like, oh, my God, they're like they were before. And, you know, yeah.
Well, not all of the rigor goes out of the body. Some of it stays. And often the mouth will stay closed for those 3 days, but sometimes it'll open a little bit because there is no muscle control there anymore. And so and it's hard, you know, people aren't used to being around death as we used to be. So all of these things are revealed in our guidebook so people know what to expect. And mainly it's knowing what to expect that takes the fear out of it. It's the unknown that scares us, so. We're trying to demystify it in every way we can.
Well, the unanticipated thing, I think, is that you look at your loved one dead and you realize that's your loved one and it's still them. I mean, I don't, you know, this. I get the idea that, you know, some people say, oh, it's just a shell. Like I did a course in when I was training people, an anatomy dissection thing, and I couldn't do it because the bodies were not... free of, I could feel the people. I couldn't, you know, there were parts, and I couldn't do it because of the feeling. I could feel it, like the hands, you know, I'd look at the hands and think, ooh, but anyway, so everybody's going to be sensitive in a different way to this, but I feel that you're actually still interacting with that person, and there's something loving about that, so.
Yes, and one of the things that's so helpful to people caring for their own loved ones and having this three-day wake is that what they'll sense is that the spirit seems to be leaving the body over those few days, and somewhere in their own body, they're feeling that body is going from life to that shell that you just mentioned. And they will say, ah, it's time to let go now. Yeah. It's time to take the body to the to the sacred fire or to the cemetery ground. And so that's a world of difference when they come to it within their own body and heart than the body being taken away immediately and feeling their heart is ripped out. That's all the difference in the world. So if there's time, I'd love to just mention that that shroud burial, actually we did two of them at our local cemetery just recently. We actually started doing green burials there many years ago, but just in this past few months, we did the first shroud-only burials at the 4 foot deep level instead of 6 feet, and it was so beautiful for everybody involved. And the first one we did was a woman who just loved the earth, and it would have been her way to give back. Actually, both the women that had the shroud burials just a week apart loved the earth very much. So everybody thought it was so great when the owner said he would allow us to place the person in the ground with just wrapped in a shroud. And they had many ceremonies. They bathed and dressed her and anointed her with oils, a whole group of women around her, singing to her, reading from various books, prayers and meditations and telling stories. And then there was a wrapping her in the shroud ceremony. And then they also decorated a cardboard cremation casket, and all of this woman who died, she was only 38, and she had an 11-year-old son, and he and all his friends helped decorate the cardboard basket casket. They painted it white and then painted it with many colors and wrote notes and all kinds of things to her. And then everyone placed her shroud-wrapped body in the cardboard casket and brought it to the cemetery and had her in this beautifully decorated casket lying on the ground beside the grave. And then they did a graveside service. Everybody, again, said more stories about her and sang songs and talked about her life and how absolutely amazing this woman was, how much she gave to her community and how much she loved her son and her family. And then they lifted the shroud out of the cardboard decorated box and lowered her into the ground because there were straps sewn on to the shroud. So they were able to use these straps and just lower her gently into the 4-foot grave, toss the straps in, throw flowers and all kinds of beautiful things into the grave with her. And then her 11-year-old son and all his friends took the earth and with shovels and covered her.
Hmm.
And it was such a moving experience.
Mm-hmm.
It was something very, very special. And I'm so grateful to the owner of that cemetery to allow us to place the body in the ground, in the shrouds, so they can return to the earth like we were meant to, you know, dust to dust.
I believe that, yeah.
And not impact the earth with all these unnecessary things.
Well, and the idea of letting flowers grow on your grave and things like that is lovely.
Yeah. So that was my most recent experience, and I know people were so moved by it, so moved.
So could you give out your website one more time and maybe your phone number as we get to the end here?
Finalpassages.org, O-R-G. Our phone number is 707-824-0268.
It's always good to repeat that twice.
Finalpassages.org and 707-824-0268. And I would just like to encourage people to check our website for courses coming up, because we have a certification program for anybody who wants to explore their own death, plan for their own death, or become a home funeral guide, such as the work I do.
Thank you. I got to let you go. Thank you so much for the interview, Jerry.
Thank you so much for having me on your program.
It was a pleasure.
Okay. Me too. Bye.
Bye. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. There's information about Your Own Health and Fitness, our guests, our practice, a free hour stream of this week's show, our archive, CD copies, and lots more. YourOwnHealthAndFitness.org, all spelled out. Or you can email us at admin@YourOwnHealthAndFitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.